WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. If you're looking for a place to travel that isn't yet overrun by tourists and is relatively inexpensive, Pico Iyer recommends Vietnam. Listen to this description. Vietnam is a smiling Southeast Asian country set amid the systems and institutions of old China, yet it is more unspoiled than Thailand and more gentle than the Middle Kingdom. Indeed, it is hard not to grow woozily romantic when enumerating the holiday seductions of the place. Well, not exactly the jungle war images most Americans associate with Vietnam. Pico Iyer has written about his travels through the Far East in the book Video Night in Kathmandu. He wrote about Japan in his book The Lady and the Monk. Iyer grew up in England and now lives in the States. His article on Vietnam is in the January issue of the Condé Nast Traveler. America doesn't yet recognize Vietnam. In fact, the State Department has a warning to travelers. Because we have no diplomatic relations, the State Department can't promise the normal consular protections for Americans. I wanted to know what kind of red tape you have to cut through to get there.
Theoretically, there's no State Department injunction against Americans going there. But there is, curiously, a Department of the Treasury regulation called, charmingly, the Trading with the Enemy Act. And under this act, you're not allowed to do business there. Americans are not allowed to do business there. We cannot call them up or send faxes there. We can only bring a limited number of goods back. And theoretically, we're not really supposed to spend a single penny with an enemy nation such as Cuba, Vietnam, North Korea. In practice, however, that's a principle, like many, mostly honored in the breach. Most of the tourists there are Americans. And what they do is to organize their trips from Canada, or most usually and most conveniently from Thailand. Thailand has quickly realized that many foreigners want to go to Vietnam, so every street corner in Bangkok is sprouting travel agencies that specialize in getting you into Vietnam, under the table, around the table, or into the back door, as well as in very legitimate and expensive ways.
What route did you take to get into Vietnam?
I went perversely through Japan, because I was in Japan at the time and set it up there. But essentially, I flew to Bangkok, and from Bangkok went to Hanoi and traveled down through the country. I also took the precaution, as many foreigners do, of not flying with Vietnam Airways. Vietnam Airways is one of those many tiny international carriers, and it's hardly international, that's regarded with terror. And with good reason, I took one flight domestically with them. Luckily, the flight took off and landed, which I think is no foregone conclusion with Vietnam Airlines. But most people try to fly in and out on Thai Air or one of the other carriers.
What are some of the stops on the tours that you took?
I essentially began in Hanoi, which is really one of the most bewitching cities one could find in Asia, in part because it's so undeveloped. At night, sometimes I would ride along in a cyclo through these little crooked streets with oil lamps around the tables and families eating on the sidewalks and illuminated lanterns. And it was really like a vision or perfect evocation of 1920s Indochina, all one's most romantic dreams about the way that part of the world was under French rule. Hue is another one of the more romantic places that I saw, because it's a repository of the old cultured Vietnam. It's the place where the schools of the higher standard, where you see all the girls dressed in traditional Ao Dai, pedaling over the perfume river in the sun, and there are the old temples and pavilions of Vietnamese emperors. And it's like Kyoto in Japan or Hangzhou in China. It's almost like a sanctuary of some vision of an old, refined country of the past, where they preserve some of the values that are being outdated elsewhere. Halong Bay is a place where there are 3,000 tiny islands set in a bay. It's often ideally misty, and you wind and meander in a boat through these islands, some of them resembling leopards, some tigers, some whales, some really anything you can imagine. And you feel as if you're in a kind of magical wonderland. There are also very interesting minority tribes to be visited in the dense rainforests and mountains of the north. 53 different groups there, and they live very much in an old animist way, utterly, it seems, untouched by the world.
You write in your article that it's as if there were two Vietnams, Saigon and everything else. How is Saigon different than the rest of the country now?
Saigon is the center of hard capital, free enterprise, bustling capitalism, essentially. It's called Ho Chi Minh City, but it's almost the opposite of what Ho Chi Minh would have visualized. So there, some of the romantic qualities I've been talking about, much less evident, and it's almost like Bangkok or Hong Kong or any of the other metropolises of the East, vibrant, full of energy, surging with commotion at night. So it feels as if it's plugged into a kind of international business circuit.
I'm interested in some of the stops on the tours of different sites. For instance, I know you were taken to the War Crimes Museum. What's in the museum?
Almost every city I visited has a war crimes museum, which is easy to recognize because it's full of howitzers, planes and tanks in the garden. So you're driving along a street in any Vietnamese city and suddenly you'll see American B-52s and the like. Inside, especially in Saigon, which has the largest of these museums, there are pictures and apparent so-called documentation of American atrocities, as they call them, and lots of pictures from American newspapers of American GIs doing unfavorable things to the Vietnamese. The one in Saigon is particularly interesting because, for example, they have a whole section called cultural ideological sabotage that consists entirely of heavy metal T-shirts and pictures of Ozzy Osbourne and T-shirts saying things like sympathy for the devil and friend of the devil, which, taken out of context, must seem incredibly sinister and malign. Though to us, it's rather curious to go into a museum and see that. You see Loma Till tablets and all the everyday stuff of the American GI's life.
Are the Cuchi tunnels where the Viet Cong, where many Viet Cong lived and stored supplies during the war, are they a tourist site now?
They're very much a tourist site. They're only 30 minutes out of Saigon, and they're quite remarkable. A small section of the tunnels, which in fact stretch for a 200-mile network around the area, a small section has been enlarged so that foreign tourists can actually descend into them and crawl along for about 50 yards. When you go down there, it's so dark that you can't sit up, you can't see anything. You're literally slithering along like a snake, and after about 30 seconds of that, you feel like fainting from claustrophobia. And when you emerge at the other end, thoroughly disoriented, you're told, well, in these tunnels, in fact, in tunnels smaller than these, Viet Cong lived not for hours, but for days, for weeks, even for months at a time. And in these tunnels, they actually erected conference halls, theaters, kitchens, restrooms, a whole underground world. And it serves as a very potent symbol of, in some ways, the tactics that the Vietnamese used. The other very powerful site that's similar to that is near Da Nang, which was the second principal American site during the war, called Marble Mountain, which is a complex of hills full of shrines and Buddha caves. And you find out that through much of the war, the Viet Cong were actually using these caves as hospitals. 5 minutes away from this is China Beach, the famous place of American TV series and legend. So you realize that all the time that Americans were enjoying R&R, recuperating on the beach below, 5 minutes away, overlooking their every movement and hiding in these caves, were the Viet Cong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pico Iyer, and in the current edition of the Condé Nast Traveler, he has an article about traveling to Vietnam and how it's becoming something of a tourist spot. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Pico Iyer is my guest, and we're talking about how Vietnam is becoming a place for travelers and tourists to go. You stayed at a lot of hotels when you were in Vietnam. Give us a sense of the range of hotels that you stayed at and what they were like.
The best hotels, not surprisingly, are in Saigon, and they're the ones that are more or less left over from the war. So you can visit the places which used to house American officers and American journalists and American diplomats. And the hotels are developing very quickly to meet the new demand of foreigners, more businessmen than tourists. And it's almost a palpable sign of how Vietnam is developing. I remember when I went into Saigon, my first day there, the lobby of my hotel was entirely empty. I spent the day wandering around the city. When I came back that evening, they had, in the course of the day, erected a bar, a whole lot of tables and chairs for drinking, and they'd essentially created a whole restaurant in the space of 10 hours. And you feel that everywhere in Vietnam, especially in Saigon, is developing at the speed of a Polaroid, really. I mean, it's developing as fast as you can watch it. The other hotels are quirky, to put it generously. And I think the best advice for staying in them is to be prepared for anything. When you open the door to your hotel room, you may find a chambermaid taking a shower there, a prostitute waiting you, cows wandering towards your door. Anything can happen. And that's where the infrastructure really does seem strange. I think for the adventurous tourist, that's a great delight, that you have this sense that things aren't formalized and that you're far, far away from the organized world that you know from New York or California or wherever. But for people who like to plan things in advance, it's decidedly a mixed blessing.
Whenever you're traveling to another country, there's always at least one moment where you feel you've been really exploited, ripped off. Did that happen to you at any point?
Relatively little, and maybe that's because I've been so hardened by bad experiences in other countries. One's always aware that the people there are eager for money, and even the guides, who become fairly good friends and with whom you keep company for a week or 2 weeks at a time, you always know that they're suddenly manufacturing trips and excursions and things which will involve you paying them in dollars and they're being able to become that much richer. I remember one day in Saigon, I told my guide that I was interested in seeing the old Chinatown part of the city in our car. He arrived at my hotel with his driver, one young woman, and the young woman's mother, and announced that we were all off to see a trade fair many, many miles out of Saigon rather than Chinatown. And I quickly realized that far from satisfying my itinerary, the main object of this trip was that he was wooing this girl and in the process sort of bribing the mother with a trip to the trade fair. And in fact, I was just another way of his insinuating himself into the hearts of this family. So you're aware that there are many things going on beneath the surface and that you may be playing a different part from the one you assigned yourself. But that's part of the fun of it.
Did you talk to people about the war when you were there?
What you find is that unsolicited, a lot of people have stories, especially in Saigon. Most of the men who are riding siklos, the equivalent of taxi drivers, are South Vietnamese who were sent to re-education camps, in many cases for 10 years. And they particularly are eager to make contact with Americans, indeed, because they're trying to leave the country. So as you're walking down the streets of Saigon, many of them will come up, they speak perfect, fluent, very idiomatic, if slightly outdated, 60s English, and they'll tell you the horrors that they had to endure in re-education camp and how much they feel discomforted in the contemporary Vietnam and how much they want to leave. People in the rest of the country tend to be very low-key and dignified, and occasionally they'll just say in passing, I lost three of my family here, my mother was killed in the Tet Offensive, whatever, but don't seem to dwell on it.
Now, I know you were born in India, grew up in England, and now live in America. But did you ever feel any sense of guilt or responsibility for the damage that was done during the war while you were in Vietnam? Was there any, you know, emotional resonance in that for you?
For me, there was less than there might be for many people. But I think the Vietnamese make that whole process easier, partially because they're so forgiving, or at least their principle is very pragmatic. Let bygones be bygones. Our concern now, the Vietnamese believe, is to create our future, and that's our top priority, rather than just raking over the past. So I think people who do feel guilt or anguish are well advised to go there and to meet the Vietnamese and to come to terms with it in that way, and to find that the country that exists now is very different from the one of stereotype and very different from the one where our forces were fighting 15 years ago.
Pico Iyer's article on Vietnam is published in the January issue of the Condé Nast Traveler. His latest book is The Lady and the Monk, Four Seasons in Kyoto. This is Fresh Air.